There are a lot of strange stories in the Bible, especially in the Old Testament, it seems like. Lots of strange stories, and our text for this morning is a prime example of that. We're going to be looking in Genesis 32, and you may want to turn in your phone or your Bible to that passage, Genesis 32, because this text, as I said, is strange, it's different. I wonder if it's a story about a man, supposedly a believer in God, a believer in God Almighty, who seems to profit from deceiving and cheating other people. Or is this a story about a God who sneaks up from behind and attacks one of the patriarchs? Or is this a story in which a man almost wins a wrestling match with God? It's hard to read stories from the Bible that don't fit our ideas about what the Bible should say. But if you've been keeping up with your Old Testament reading or listening to the sermons that Jeff and I have been preaching for the last several weeks, you've already come across several of them. What do you do with stories like these? What do you do with such an unpredictable God who apparently is willing and able to show up at any time and place and do the most surprising things? One thing is clear. God is not as remote as most people seem to think he is. And he's nowhere near as passive or predictable as many people want him to be. They want a predictable God. God is not predictable. There are many folks, even some Christians, who would like to think that God is constrained by rules of conduct that they consider appropriate. The Pharisees were so stunned by the conduct of Jesus that even though they were among the most religious people the world has ever known, they didn't believe for one instant he could possibly be the Son of God. Because look at what he's doing. There are many folks, even some Christians, who would like to think that God can be predicted. But here in Genesis 32, we find a man in a quandary. He's stuck here at the Jabbok River, between two terrible choices, forced to come face to face with the consequences of his past actions, his past sins. The con is finally up. To the west is the Mediterranean Sea. To the east is the desert. He can't go west or east. To the north is his powerful father-in-law, Laban. And Laban, his father-in-law, has threatened to kill him. After 20 years of living in his father-in-law's family, his welcome has entirely run out, so he's running for his life. He and his father-in-law were two of a kind. They've been engaged in a competition to outmaneuver each other for two decades now. At times, it appeared Laban had gained the upper hand. You remember that at one point, he managed to insert his older daughter into the wedding tent when Jacob thought he married the younger one. But in the end, it was Jacob who gained so much wealth that when Laban's own son saw Jacob's herds, it felt like Jacob had managed to steal their inheritance right from under their noses. They believed he had somehow managed, through cunning and deception, to take their birthright from them. And haven't we heard something like that before in Jacob's story? So while Laban is off shearing sheep, Jacob hurriedly gathers his possessions, his two wives, Laban's daughters, and his 11 sons, Laban's grandsons, and he sneaks out in the middle of the night to head back home. When Laban finds out about it, he's infuriated. He believes Jacob has stolen everything he has. So he comes with a small army of servants and relatives to get his daughters and property back. And if Jacob comes to harm in the process, well, so be it. If it hadn't been for God who came to Jacob's rescue, he appeared to Laban in a dream the night before he caught up with Jacob. Laban would have made a mess of Jacob in his dreams, but God told Laban, in so many words, hands off. So he can't kill him. He can't take his property. But he has plenty to say. He and Jacob wind up agreeing eventually to build a witness heap of stones as a boundary marker between them. Jacob is not to go north of the line, and Laban agrees not to go south of it. Laban is so convinced that his son-in-law is a cheat and a thief that he's willing to forego any further contact with his daughters and grandchildren in order to be rid of Jacob. And Laban has so mistreated and swindled Jacob that his own daughters, Jacob's wives, are happy to leave their father behind, never to see him again. So they depart from each other like two warring countries who fought to a draw and agreed to a permanent truce. It is not peace. It's more like North and South Korea. So Jacob can't go north. The problem is that to the south is his own sordid past in the form of his big brother, Esau. 20 years ago, Jacob had made a quick escape to the north because he'd gotten wind that his brother was threatening to kill him. And if you remember how Jacob had swindled him, you can understand why Esau was so furious with him. So now things are really messed up. They're so messed up to the north that Jacob's having to run into the jaws of a lion to the south. He's hoping against hope that Esau has forgotten about losing his birthright and then having his father's blessing flat out stolen from him through lies and deception. But Jacob has no other options. There's nowhere else to go. He's 40 years old, and he's been living by hook and by crook his whole life. He stole his father's blessing and took advantage of his brother's hunger to maneuver his birthright and then managed somehow to get away with most of his father-in-law's property. But it looks like the jig is finally up. Looks like his past is finally catching up with him. He's not going to go down without playing every card he's got. He figures he's gotten ahead all this time by being crafty when the chips are down. So he's going to play it out to the end. Maybe he'll figure out a way to get out of trouble with Esau. He can't go north. He has to go south. After all, it's been 20 years. Maybe Esau's anger has abated, at least somewhat. He sends messengers to announce to Esau that he's coming home with herds of livestock, men servants and maid servants, and a large family. He hopes that that will make Esau more willing to accept him. But the messengers come hurrying back to report that Esau is in fact heading north as fast as he can, and he has 400 armed men coming with him. What can Jacob do now? In great fear and distress, he looks at his cards and he starts laying them down. First, he divides all his herds and servants into two groups. He figures if Esau attacks one group, maybe some of the other group will have a chance to escape. And then he prays. I mean, you know, when all else fails, you can pray, right? Jacob is hoping maybe he can get God to rescue him again from Esau like he did from Laban. After all, he reminds God in his prayer, God's promise to make him prosperous, to make his descendants a great nation. So it isn't just Jacob's life that's in danger here. God's reputation might suffer as well. God, you have to save me. And then he sends servants ahead with gifts, 5 in all, and each more extravagant than the one before, so that as Esau travels north, the gifts from Jacob will arrive one after another, and maybe those gifts will be considered in some ways a payment for what Jacob has stolen from him, and maybe they'll appease him somewhat, they're so extravagant, or maybe they'll bog him down with herds to manage until he's had a chance to cool off. And then, fearing a surprise nighttime attack, Jacob takes his family across to the south side of the Jabbok River, the side close to Esau, and he returns himself alone to the north side of the river, furthest from Esau. 20 years ago, he fled Esau with just a staff in his hand, and he survived and thrived, so maybe he could do it again. He's laid every card down one by one. A buffer zone has been created to protect his most precious assets, small herds one by one, 2 huge herds with servants, his wife, his children, and then most precious of all, of course, himself. He'll have a chance to save his own skin, even if his servants and family, even if his wives and children are slaughtered. He leaves them south of the river and he comes back to the north side. Fear and desperation can have, I guess, that kind of impact in a person's life. Just when you think maybe Jacob has left the scheming, deceitful con games of the past behind him, fear rises its ugly head and he's back to just looking out for number one. Fear can do crazy things to a person. After all, this is the same man who stole a blessing from his own brother by deceiving his blind father. I wonder if Jacob had time to reflect a little on the events that had brought him to this point in his relationship with Esau. The events that brought him to this point where the calm was finally completely out. His relationship with Esau, twin brother. But Esau came out of the womb first with Jacob's tiny hand clasped tightly around his heel. That's where the name Jacob came from. After all, it meant heel grabber, which is a Hebrew expression that meant deceiver or cheater. And he'd lift up to his name. There was a day Esau had been hunting, and he came in from hunting. He was starving to death, so Jacob made this red bean stew, and Esau's there starving to death. He has to have that stew. And Jacob says, I'll give it to you if you'll give me your birthright. And then the blessing. With the help of his mother, Jacob pretended to be his hairy, larger, older brother. With his mother's help, he put skin on his arm so if his father felt them, they would be hairy. And he deepened his voice to sound more like his brother. And he deceived his blind father and got his brother's blessing. 20 years ago, running from Esau, Jacob had gone to sleep with a rock for a pillow. And so he didn't sleep well. He had dreams. In one of those dreams, God appeared to him at the top of a ladder extending into heaven. And he promised to be with him and to bless him and to bring him back. Jacob was the son of promise. He had known this all his life, and at times he relied on it. You know, the story of Jacob in some ways reminds me of the story of Abraham, who received the promise from God, and the promise didn't seem to be going the way it should be, so Abraham manipulated events to try to make it happen. If God wasn't going to do it, he's going to do it himself, and he wound up going into his wife's servant, and lied about his wife and did all kinds of things to try to get the promise to happen when God wasn't making it happen. And you see the same thing happen with Jacob. God, he's the child of promise, but he tries to make things happen for himself by hook and by crook instead of relying on God. So, in the darkness, when he's made himself as safe as possible, alone on the north side of the Jabbok River, somebody attacks him. That takes us to our text in Genesis 32, 22 through 31. That night, Jacob got up and took his two wives, his two female servants, his 11 sons, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. After he had sent them across the stream, he sent over all his possessions. So Jacob was left alone. And a man wrestled with him till daybreak. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. Then the man said, let me go, for it is daybreak. But Jacob replied, I will not let you go unless you bless me. The man asked him, well, what's your name? Jacob, he answered. Then the man said, your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel, because you have struggled with God and with humans and have overcome. Jacob said, please tell me your name. But he replied, why do you ask my name? Then he blessed him there. So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, it's because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared. The sun rose above him as he passed Peniel, and he was limping because of his hip. One of the strangest stories in all the Bible. He comes away wounded, but he comes away blessed and with a new name, Israel. Jacob learned that night that we can't get what we want out of life by our own plans and by our own power. Jacob was a good wrestler because he had had a lot of practice. And he learned that night that the person he'd been wrestling all his life wasn't his father Isaac or his brother Esau or his father-in-law Laban. All of his life, Jacob had been wrestling with God. And he had achieved great success in terms of material possessions, but didn't know anything about joy or love or hope or peace. We want faith to be easy, but it is not easy. We want to have faith and have the blessings of God and still be in control. But faith requires we give up control, and we don't give up that control easily. It takes a lot of wrestling with God until we learn we can't win and we get wounded in the process. Real faith is a struggle with God for control that leaves God in charge and us walking away wounded. He says, "Who are you?" And we answer, "I'm Jacob. I'm a con man, a liar, a pretender, a manipulator, a schemer. I'm self-centered, I'm selfish, I'm unloving. That's my name." And he says, "I'm giving you a new name. From now on, you are Israel," which has two meanings. One is one who wrestles with God. And the other meaning is God rules. It takes a long wrestling match with God before our identity becomes God rules. When the sun came up that morning, God was gone, and there was no more Jacob. Israel was exhausted, and he was walking with a permanent limp, but he was blessed. He crossed the river, and he went ahead of his family to meet Esau face to face, because now his fear and distress has been replaced by trust in the God who wounded him, that gave him a new name. Learning to trust God is a lifelong struggle that leaves us wounded. Frederick Buechner calls this the magnificent defeat. Walter Brueggemann calls it the crippling victory. David says in Psalm 51, verse 17, "My sacrifice, O God, is a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart. You, God, will not despise." I want to share a lengthy quote by Frederick Buechner about this. He says, "Power, success, happiness, as the world knows them, are his who will fight for them hard enough, but peace, love, joy are only from God. And God is the enemy whom Jacob fought there by the river, of course, and whom in one way or another we all of us fight. God, the beloved enemy, our enemy because before giving us everything, he demands of us everything. Before giving us life, he demands our lives, ourselves, our wills, our treasure. Will we give them, you and I? I do not know," he says. "I only remember the last glimpse that we have of Jacob limping home against the great conflagration of the dawn. Remember Jesus of Nazareth staggering on broken feet out of the tomb toward the resurrection, bearing on his body the proud insignia of the defeat, which is victory, the magnificent defeat of the human soul at the hands of God. There's nothing as wonderful as the defeat of human pride at the hands of a loving God, because the path to an abundant life starts with a reminder that God rules, that Jesus is King of kings and Lord of lords. He is my King of kings and my Lord of lords, and I am his subject." So what happened that night by the Jabbok River? Was it a physical wrestling match? Was it a night like maybe you've had and I've had, where you spend all night wrestling with God and you realize you've been going the wrong direction, you made bad choices, and it's left you in a place where you're finally left with your only hope is to lay down your life and serve God and make Him Lord. And then you wake up a changed person with a changed name and a new plan. I don't know. I tend to think, and as Doug said, you know, he did have that limp. But either way, he was transformed. So humble yourself in the sight of the Lord, and He will lift you up.